Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Takeshi Morisato. Today, I'll be talking to Marnia Lazarek, who is the author of Foucault's Orient, The Conundrum of Cultural Difference from Tunisia to Japan, a book that was published in 2017 by Berikham Books. Hello, Marnia.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We like to just talk about this book in this New Books Network, but perhaps like, can you start with who you are and maybe in conjunction with the question of how this book project came to be in your life?
Okay. Yeah, I'm a sociologist, you know, by training. I got my PhD here in New York City from New York University, a private institution. I became interested in historical sociology as well as gender relations. So even though I have taught, you know, a variety of courses, you know, one very common course I have taught, frequent course was, you know, international development, because that got me into the issue of a global understanding of why is it that some nations, you know, have become industrialized and others, you know, are still having difficulties, you know, doing so. Because I also have an abiding interest in theory, and I also taught courses on theory, classical as well as contemporary, I'm interested in Foucault. Because as you know, for a long time, it continues today, you know, he was the rage, you know, everywhere, not only, you know, in the US, but everywhere. And suddenly academia went along. And so in one of my theory courses, I had to teach about Foucault. And I became interested in the way in which he opened up the book, you know, The Order of Things, shows. And at first, it didn't bother me. And then as I taught the course again and again, I started stumbling on it. Why on earth is he starting with this Chinese encyclopedia? Not only that, but he devotes, you know, quite, you know, some space to explaining its meaning. Not only that, but he also said, in fact, he got his inspiration for the book from the Chinese encyclopedia. Seemed like I was the only one who was, you know, intrigued, you know, by this quotation. And because when I looked it up, you know, I saw people say, isn't that the wonderful quotation that sets the stage, you know, for the history really of the idea of science in the West? And it kept bothering me. And then I decided I have to look into it. So I started running into Chinese scholars, who actually had a problem with it. And then I decided to look into the way in which he wrote it. And if you actually look at it carefully, he blurs the fiction and the reality. Stretches of time, he's talking about it as if it were real. us, and then he interjects, you know, the name of Borges. Borges did this to us. And then he goes on, uses it again as real, and counterposes it to the French, you know, fictitious work of Rabelais and Gargantua. And then, to my surprise, that's the starting point. And they lack the table. But I don't understand how that fictitious, you know, bizarre enumeration of the encyclopedia held together. Whereas if you read about Pantagruel and all these horrible things, you know, like, you know, hemorrhoids and the spiders, they were all heterogeneous objects, but they were held together. What were they held together by? His mouth. And I said, come on now, how could the mouth be the table? And so that was the beginning of telling us, essentially, the mental difference between the Occident and the Orient. So then, of course, I had to teach about the history of madness. And then I realized that the 1961 edition had a quotation that put a frame around my conundrum, if you will, with the issue of the Chinese encyclopedia. There, in very stark terms, he's telling us there is a universal reason, which essentially is Western, and there is this limit to the universal reason. And you wonder, why would the universal reason have a limit? And where is the limit? The limit is this Oriental reason, the one that produced the Chinese encyclopedia, which is a fictitious text.
Yeah, that's really interesting starting point, because it seems like Borges is trying to demonstrate a kind of limitation reason through the fictitious recreation of this Chinese encyclopedia. And as Asian, it does look convincing, right? That it does look like this is sort of the categorization that represents a certain encyclopedic thinking that categorizes things in such a way that we can somehow, you know, comprehend everything in the universe through this categorization. But it shows the limit of that endeavor. But I wonder, like, Foucault and Borges are coming from like a little bit different angle to the same question. It just seems like Borges, for instance, seems to be much more, you know, interested in how, yeah, do you have some, like, I guess, input from your side about this sort of comparative differences and sameness between Borges and Foucault?
I think it is well known that Borges made fun of us academics, our self-importance, you know, and quotations on top of quotations. So he said, well, look, there is this man, Dr. Franz Kuhn, and actually he was a real character, but, you know, he had not, he had written, you know, the Celestial Emporium of Benevolent Knowledge, but he didn't write any Chinese encyclopedia. So he attributed the Chinese encyclopedia, which is the figment of Borges's own imagination, this real character called, you know, Franz Kuhn, for what purpose? To show us that all taxonomies, all classifications are arbitrary. And he goes on from there to show us how the Bibliographic Institute of Brussels, which classifies books, the ones we go to the library to read, the classification itself is bizarre. And he shows us the bizarreness, you know, of the classification. So that's his conclusion. All taxonomies are actually arbitrary. That's the conclusion that Foucault just swipes to the side and takes this Chinese encyclopedia out of the context that Borges gave it and makes it into the absolute representation of Oriental thought as a limit experience. So different. This is quite different. This is what we don't know about Borges. Borges was making fun of all of us, creating these things. And actually, he goes on to tell us that there is this character, John Wilkins, 16th, 17th century, exactly the centuries that Foucault was writing about, who had, you know, he wanted to create a universal language, one that you could, you know, you could learn in a few days. And then he goes on, but he divided the universe, you know, into categories, and the categories into differences, and the differences into species. And, you know, so he goes on and on. But Wilkins was a real character. And however, Foucault does not mention him. And you know, there is a woman, Sidonie Klaus, who argues, I don't want to get into the controversy because I didn't do research, but who argues that Foucault actually willingly excluded Wilkins because it perturbed the neatness of his view in the things that you have the West and then you have the East, and there's rationality in the West, and you have this, you know, limit, you know, to rationality in the East. So I think, and because Foucault does not usually give us footnotes and references, if you have not read the piece by Borges, you don't even know whether this encyclopedia, you know, exists or not, or whether it existed and Borges, you know, made the fictitious, you know, thing out of it. We don't know that.
Mm-hmm. You know, maybe that ties me to this question that I have inherently for the Foucault studies. So, I mean, this tension between Borges and Foucault really represents this sort of like a poet's showing us the limit of philosophy and philosophical reasoning to categorize everything neatly into these framework of thinking. But then Foucault seemed to be using that concept to say this is a limit concept to the Western universalizing reason. But isn't it another taxonomy that somehow put things in a neat box? Or would you disagree by saying that maybe this limit concept is much more explosive and far-reaching implications?
The concept of limit experience, as you know, comes from surrealism, where, you know, the authors like Bataille and others, you know, wanted to push the envelopes, the limit, where the individual would come close to, you know, the limit is really death, right? You know, go beyond, you know, the world, you know, of, you know, everyday life that you know, that you're familiar with, and get into something else. And so it was, I don't think Foucault had an ulterior reason, except he wanted to show this fundamental divide between the universal or universalizing Western reason and the East that has a thought that cannot be fathomed. And perhaps he adds, someday we should do the history of this other thought. But as a Japanese scholar said to me, I think his name was Yasuo Kobayashi.
Oh, wow. Oh, you, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
He said, you know, universal reason doesn't have a limit. So when Foucault posits a universal reason and says there's a limit to it, he's stopping, you know, the universal scope of reason. He's not looking at this limit represented by the Oriental reason. He's not stopping and saying, but this is part of the universal reason. Because there is no reason why the universe itself would be confined to the West. This is ridiculous. And today, as you know, we have this sort of revolution in thinking where we were trying to be as inclusive as possible. We were trying to see, you know, how you know, philosophies, you know, from the non-West, you know, actually had some common elements with philosophies in the West. And if you want to look at it, actually the West borrowed some elements from the philosophies of the Orient.
Right, right, yeah.
Look at the German Enlightenment that was interested in Confucius. Because they realized that Confucius actually had elements of the Enlightenment, which they in Germany were looking for and looking to develop. So I'm afraid, without diminishing essentially the importance, you know, from the importance of Foucault, I mean, he fumbled this, you know, because his life's work is to capture the essence and the uniqueness of the West and the Western culture. He does it critically, and this is one confounding element, you know, for his readers, that, oh, he's a critic of the West. But he says specifically, I'm not a critic in order to, you know, destroy it, but I'm a critic to understand how it was constituted, period. He hasn't rejected it. He has actually endorsed its values. And so this, in essence, stumbles against, you know, his aura of being left philosopher, because people associate him with the left. As such, you know, he's saying, you know, these very revolutionary and fantastic things that can help. Yes, he has some absolutely very, very inspiring concepts. However, you know, and he did things that are associated with the left, which is demonstrating, you know, on behalf of immigrants, you know, on behalf of Solidarność, you know, in Poland, you know, doing work, you know, with the prisoners in France. Actually, it was his companion, Defer, was doing it. He simply lent his name to it. That's what Defer told me. So he has this aura around him, but when you start digging, you realize that he actually could not comprehend the diversity of the world, even though he was the one who said he wanted to do a reportage D-Day, because he felt that the most exciting ideas were occurring elsewhere. And he wanted to go and, you know, study them. And he put together a team, you know, of scholars and journalists to do that. And he went to Iran to do a reportage on the Iranian Revolution. But he always comes back to his, you know, fulcrum, which is the specificity of Western culture. And in this sense, in my view, he's closer to Weber, whose work was to show the uniqueness of the West, than to anybody else.
Right. Is it sort of like uniqueness in relation to the rest of the world to show it as a particular unique kind of culture in this global context? Or is it a little bit more like anti-left, putting the Western culture into the pedestal? So the conundrum with this concept of the Orient and limit concept, that it seems like Foucault is capable of providing us the theoretical foundation for doing multicultural, cross-cultural, both philosophy and sociology and anthropology. To me, that it seems to provide us at least some sort of like a theoretical foundation for doing, paying attention to the non-West. But when you read your book and see the account of his experience in Tunisia or Iran and Japan, we all end with a little bit of anti-climax feeling, it that eventually he comes back, as you say, eventually comes back to the West and talk about specificity of the Western culture. So it is a conundrum, and I'm wondering what your take on this.
Yeah, I think that's description of the West. Yeah, you're posing a very important question, and that's the thing that one has to navigate. This is why in the introduction I say, look, this is not a takedown of Foucault. This is not a negative critique of Foucault. This is simply opening a space for a productive discussion of areas that have been left in the shadow. And so You know, the development of countries, some countries, you know, is you know, can be, you know, common to others, and it can be unique. Yes, there could be a unique constellation of circumstances that allowed some countries to hit upon certain, you know, developments, you know, that led them to become industrialized and others not. And it's inevitable that one has to ask oneself, what was the role of imperialism and, you know, colonialism, giving a boost to what, you know, the West sees as its, you know, uniqueness, and being a break on the development of others, not to reify colonialism and see it, you know, as the cause of everything. I'm not saying that, but just the phenomenon itself, you know, the way it developed. So that's a legitimate question, right? But that's different from writing books and doing analysis that time and again take the West as the standard for understanding difference without entering the complexity of that difference. And this is why, to me, Foucault's experience of Japan is so crucial, and few people really talk about it. How he responds to the people who ask him questions, the scholars in Japan, how he responds to the people who came to listen to his lectures. And some of them ask him very, very crucial questions. Do you think that we have something to offer, that the East has something to offer to the crisis that exists in the West? And he's, you know, of course, he acknowledges that there is a crisis in the West, crisis of thought. And but what does he attribute its origin to? The end of empire, the end of colonialism. And for the French, it's the loss of Algeria. Bastion. I mean, this is so heartrending. At the same time, when he talks about the Reportage d'Idées and the ideas brewing elsewhere in the world, you know, he tells us that there's some knowledge that is subjugated. You know, this is in his lectures at the Collège de France, subjugated knowledges. And these knowledges become marginal and continue to be marginalized. And the standard, you know, for keeping their marginalization is always to accuse them of not being scientific. So, okay, you could say, oh my God, this is great, because this is true. But then this is, you know, counterbalanced by the essential thing, which is, you know, the West is the standard. Even when he had to, when he was asked about madness, because that's his specialty, right? In Japan, or he asked. So he said, well, madness in Japan, he says representations of madness. So we're no longer talking about madness, but representation of madness. So in Japan, madness is represented, you know, as the sacred. Whereas in the West, there you go, he could never enter, you know, the complexity of the difference that he's talking about. He had always to counterpose it to the reality of Western culture. Whereas in the West, it is represented as truth-telling. Now, of course, come on. You know, a madman may be represented as sacred, but it is the sacred. What is the sacred? It is the source of the truth in a non-sacred world. So that caused, actually, you know, a few lone Frenchmen like Thierry Marchais and François Julien to say, well, the difference is really so thin that there is no difference. It is an indifference.
Okay, right. Yeah.
So this is what, so one has to see both Foucaults. The Foucault who comes up with this wonderful concept, subjugated knowledge. We know subjugated knowledge. So he wasn't the first one to say it, you know, but you know the way he says it. Foucault comes about in the crisis of the West, but then the Foucault says, the West is the standard for understanding everything. So he cannot conceive of a culture in its own terms. And of course, this is where your question is important. You brought up the issue of anthropology. Does it give us a theory that will help us to build an anthropology that does not eliminate difference? But the fact is, to do that kind of work, you have to accept humanism. And he rejected anthropology. He said it's actually in a deep sleep. It's an anthropological sleep, and because he rejected, the fundamental, definition of anthropology by Kant, and he was a translator of anthropology from the pragmatic standpoint, which Kant had taught as a course for many, many years, and towards the end of his life, he put those notes together and published the text. And even then, instead of going after some very important element in Kant's, like his fundamental racism, he goes after, human nature. He rejects it because it has an empirical transcendental a priori. It posits the existence of a human nature and then proceeds to study the manifestations of that human nature empirically. So in fact, there is no such thing as human nature because for Foucault, man is dead. Study is something that's dead. So what you can study is language. So even his interpretation of Kant's anthropology was reductive. He introduced the specificity of human beings to language, not, because human nature is universal, right? We all share it. So it's his obsession with rejection of anything that's universal, but at the same time, positing that Western rationality is universal. So that's the inner contradiction, which people do not, really dwell on or even raise.
Yeah, I'm always. The tension even comes from the title of your book, "The Foucault's the Orient." In the context of Asian studies, like the name that you mentioned, François Julien, that follows this sort of like a Foucauldian tradition, are severely criticized as not being attentive to what's actually happening. In the East, so Orientalism is usually a really negative charge term, but you're saying that it's the perfect description of what Foucault was actually doing as theoretical thinker in Tunisia and Iran and Japan. Is that the message that you are?
The message is not that Foucault was an Orientalist because he had no personal investment, in bringing down, Oriental cultures. Yeah, no, it's not the kind of Orientalism that Said, talked about. He hasn't written a book on this. He has not written a book on any culture. His books were all on Western culture. So from my perspective, the Orient, because he's the one who said there's a divide between the Occident, l'Occident et l'Orient. I gave him the label. He used it. So his commitment is to his philosophical theoretical orientation, which is his, a rejection of a cosmopolitan humanist, anthropology. of course, that has to do with his, you know, objection, you know, and, you know, after being a member of the Communist Party for a couple of years, you know, he rejected Marx. So he was rejecting everything that's universal, you know, because, you know, look, Western reason, you know, cannot, you know, lost, you know, interest and faith in its progress, you know, it's in a state of crisis, and the crisis, you know, shows us, you know, it's very well demonstrated by the collapse of imperialism. So as long as imperialism was in place, there was a crisis. When it collapses, there's a crisis. So it means, you know, virtually it means that the existence, the confidence in the universality of the West, you know, was predicated on the existence of the empire. So he's not an Orientalist in the sense that we define Orientalism, but the Orient as a reality, as a phenomenon, as an idea, posed a problem for his philosophical theoretical system.
That's
why I called it Foucault's Orient.
It was really interesting to see that his position in, like, his attitude or the ways in which he interact with the experience in Tunisia and Iran and Japan are quite different from each other. It seems in Tunisia he was just kind of visiting, almost like a touristy visiting, and observing the phenomena from outside. But then in Iran, he was a lot more theoretically engaged, but it was very intellectual work. But then in Japan, he seemed to be kind of sort of like emotionally taken in as...
Totally.
Yeah.
And that's a very important a remark, you know, that you're making. This is why I foreground the concept of experience, which meant a lot to him, right? So what was his experience in Tunisia, in Iran, in Japan? And he really, the only place where he lived a longer period of time is really Tunisia. But as you said, you know, Tunisia is the French assimilated Orient. He was in another province of France. I just lost. So he spoke only French. He lived in this beautiful area, you know, overlooking the Mediterranean called Sidi Bouzaïd. He only spoke to students who spoke French. He didn't know one word of Arabic. And the student who rebelled against the state was one, Benjanet, you know, who only spoke Arabic because he was a graduate of the Arabic-speaking, you know, very famous Zitouna University. He couldn't do it. And the poor guy had been, you know, condemned to 20-some years, you know, in opposition to the state. And so at Tunisia, and then he was also, you know, a guest, as he said, because, you know, the Tunisian government was absolutely ecstatic, you know, to have Foucault, you know, teaching as a guest faculty at the University of Tunis. And even though he helped, you know, the student by smuggling, you know, smuggling them, you know, carrying them, you know, burying typewriters, you know, and leaflets in his house. And again, this is it. You know, this is what confuses people. That's a left thing, right?
Right, exactly, yeah.
And then he wouldn't say anything against the state. He said, but he knew. I mean, he knew that nothing could happen to him because of his name and because Bourguiba was so happy to have him, so happy that he sent him a box of dates. But in the meantime, he was putting down the student revolt for their, you know, half-baked Marxism. Was not, you know, scientific Marxism. It was Sino-Castrism. My gosh, you know, and you are the one who wanted to look at, you know, these, you know, simmering ideas. Why couldn't you see that behind the mask of Marxism was a simmering idea? And this is what one of his students, Ahmed Hasnawi, told him. He said, look, you have to understand. When students here want to be Marxist, Maoist, Trotskyist, I mean, the whole spectrum, they're not really adopting the doctrine as a way of life. They simply want to se dépendre, which is a word that he likes very much, to be, you know, before the state, to be other than what the state thinks they are, just Tunisians. We are not that. We are, you know, these people who are opposing you. So it didn't matter whether the Marxism was scientific or not, but was the Marxism of the French students really scientific? Then, you know, you stumble on this, you say, oh my gosh, come on, Foucault.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah, it has a sense of like really anticlimactic, the maldigestion of, yeah, it's very different from what you imagine from reading this text.
No, when you start digging, you say, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And actually, Defer told me, you know, we have to be careful not to put too much stock in interviews, because interviews are less guarded than, you know, the written text. I said, yes. But if you read the text in the original of the interview, and then you counterpose that to what he says in the context of the uniqueness, you know, of the universality of the West, that, you know, countenances no, you know, no limit and no contradiction, and then you see, and especially when he uses the word mentalité, because Defer told me, yeah, mentalité, which Foucault used to explain the difference between the Japanese and him, you know, he didn't understand them because of the mentalité, positive word in the French, you know, language. He said his, you know, his vocabulary. Then I interviewed the translator who accompanied Foucault during his 1978 trip, you know, to Japan. And he said, oh, absolutely. I even have the tape. He did say mentalité. So, you know, I think he said something that I'm not responding to. So Tunisia, to go back to Tunisia, so the problem is, when he wanted to make sense of this difference, whether Tunisian, you know, Iranian or Japanese, in Tunisia, he didn't see any difference. He even was telling his students, you know, how come you're all speaking French, you know, even though now the country is independent. That's a very important observation, you know. Yeah, so the continuation of French influence. But he was perfectly comfortable with continuing that French, you know, influence. He certainly was not teaching them anything revolutionary. He was teaching about Descartes. He was teaching about, you know, things like that.
Yeah. But it's such an interesting word that he uses, the mentalité, that this sort of, yeah, as you say, it's a positive term. So recognize that perhaps there's some kind of reasoning or minding that happening in that cultural other for him, or what's the positivity about this term?
It's not positive. That's the thing. It's actually negative. You know, actually, I go into the etymology of it, you know, how it was used by the historical school of the Annales. At some point, it was used to understand the way of thinking of people who lived in the 13th century, 14th century, 15th century. And then with time, it became a shorthand for saying that, you know, there are people who like think straight, and those whose understanding of things is very different. You know, there's always this lingering connotation of negativity. So when you say c'est leur mentalité, and it's just the way they think. You know, this is
dismissive. Could be dismissive. Yeah,
dismissive,
right.
Actually. But it was an evolution in the meaning of it, you know. And actually, the anthropologist Lucien Lévy-Brul, he was one of the first people to use it when he talked about la mentalité primitive, you know, the way of thinking of primitive people. So when you don't understand people and you think that they're acting in an odd way, it's leur mentalité. It's a bit, So his apprehension, if you will, of others is mediated by three terms. You know, one is colonialism. The other one is revolution. And, you know, the third one is the way that they think, right? So in Tunisia was a blank to him. He was projecting his conception of Carthage. He was in Greece, in Tunisia. He wasn't in Tunisia, he was in Greece. And he was, he even took a drive with Defer to Libya, you know, to Sirte, you know, to retrace the itinerary of Julian Black's, you know, novel, you know. And he said, what we were concerned about is, you know, how to understand the survival of Greek homosexual practices among homosexuals in Tunisia. That's what we're interested in. Not the revolution of the students, you know, they assigned no castrates, but, you know, the homosexual practices of the Tunisians that resembled, that were the same as those that existed in Greece. I said, wait a second, that was a long time ago. And now, you know.
Yeah, there's so many developments since the beginning of the...
This is a tradition of talking about survivals of the past in the present. This is the conservative tradition that people do today. You know, they do it when they, you know, study, you know, illiterate, you know, societies, how they're reproducing, you know, the systematic, you know, and just traditions of the past, and they just get passed on, like, you know, unchanged. So he said to me, well, yeah, you're right. There have been changes, and the changes are, hold on to your chair, the rise of feminism and the rise of Islamism. So this changed, you know, the practices, but that's what they were looking into. So colonialism, you know, for Foucault in Tunisia explains the Tunisian situation. It was unproblematic. He had nothing. There was nothing, you know, fantastic, you know, to think about. He was still in French territory. It's the assimilated, annihilated Orient in France's backyard. Iran was a different story. And he tells us it has never been colonized. So then it makes it interesting. And there was a revolution. So here, revolution and religion and colonization. So then he became, I thought he was on the verge perhaps of breaking through, but, you know, he retracted. Well, he, you know, he said, you know, he retrenched and he said, oh, he assimilated the Iranian Revolution, you know, to the French Revolution. He read the fervor, the religious fervor he saw in the revolution in Iran. He read it back into the French Revolution. And he said, actually, the French Revolution was the first political spirituality, you know, revolution. Because the individuals, you know, subjected themselves to this new thing, universal reason. Again, read French, Western reason. So, and then when he goes to Japan, bingo, he had both religion and, you know, everything else. You know, he tried to understand Zen Buddhism. You know, the interview that I had with both the Japanese and his interpreter was totally, you know, it was fun. You know, it was not like deepened. But again, as in Iran, he fathomed there was something that he really should understand that would get him out of his cocoon. He invited Masao Maruyama. And teach at the college, and also teach him about this enigma of Japan. Then, you know, Maruyama, you know, got sick, and then the project, you know, fell through. As his interpreter noted, rightly so, Foucault never talked about, you know, Zen Buddhism after that, ever.
It's just so fascinating because his analysis of the Western culture and Western mind and reason, it's so enlightening in a sense of the showing that these problems that he has and the self-diagnosis is so well.
But not transformative of his work.
Yeah. But so perhaps like maybe this is slightly off the book, but maybe question to you as author of a book on Foucault and also your specialist in sociology, right? Am I correct? Maybe the simple question is, how would you recommend students and young philosophers to read Foucault? Like, how should we read Foucault? And how did your engagement with Foucault shape your work as a sociologist? Because precisely your work is not trying to repeat the same problem as Foucault did, for instance.
Yeah, that's a very big question to answer. Yeah. If I have any recommendation to make, is read critically. Because I think the ideal graduate training is to tell students to have a critical perspective on what they read. Unfortunately, a critical perspective is sometimes associated with denigration and rejection. That's not my perspective. You can use an author's concept only if you have, you know, understood what they mean. And only if they are better than an alternative. You can do that only by having a critical perspective. So critique is not denigration and it's not rejection. This is something that people really do not always understand. So that's one thing. The other thing is read him if you want to understand Western culture and how it perceives itself and how it sees itself as universal. If you want a recipe for studying your own culture, you're not going to get it. Foucault was a left-leaning revolutionary. Mm-hmm. However, he has a way of understanding political events, you know, from a literary perspective. If you look at his work on the state and all of that in his lectures at the Collège de France, it's interesting, but people see in it already political theory. I don't do that, but I find it interesting. So you do find some concepts that are resting. So he has worked a lot on how on wordsmithing, how to create the right, you know, expression. So some of the concepts are really attractive. And some of the thoughts, too, when he says all knowledge is, in fact, unjust. Studying others is committing a sort of injustice. Yes. So this is right. This is wonderful.
Fantastic. Right. Yeah.
But then they have any notion of the others.
Right.
So there is no theology of liberation here. There is no manifesto of liberation. But there are some very exciting and inspiring concepts that one could run off with, provided that they understand them and define them. I just reviewed the book where, you know, somebody was saying subjectification. What am I supposed to understand? You know, he used it, but it was also translated as subjectivation. So which one is it? So you really have to understand this thing. So yes, sometimes when he's talking about the individual, you feel like he's talking about the universal individual, but in fact, he's talking about the Western individuals. But you can use that. You can use that. So that's my perspective.
Fantastic. Unfortunately, we're coming closer to the end, but I would like to still spend a little time to talk about the future. So this book was written in 2017, and since then, you have written multiple books. So perhaps, like, can you tell us a little bit about those books? And I'm looking forward to interviewing you again over these books. But also, like, what are you working on in conjunction with the past works of yours?
Yeah, so in between, I did a second edition of my a book that somehow became a sort of reference. And that's The Eloquence of Silence, Algerian Women in Question. So I did the second edition of that. And then I wrote Islamic feminism and the discourse of post-liberation. The subtitle is A Cultural Turn in Algeria. And I published an article with the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation in Berlin on historical revisionism of the Algerian War. There's a whole generation, young generation of French historians, you know, who are actually arguing that there was no revolution, that the Algerian War was simply a war of independence. There you go, that tradition. No specificity. Let's banalize it. And I'm writing a book on that, expanding it, but I'm doing it, you know, quite slowly.
Fantastic. So that's the current project that you're working on, this revisionist history and how you try to counter that sort of a movement. Wow, fantastic. So good luck for the forthcoming books. And actually, thank you so much for talking with us today about this book. And it's been a really pleasure to talk about this, really the conundrums and Foucault's treatment of Orient. Thank you so much, Marnia.
Thank you for inviting me. And very nice meeting you.
Thank you so much. This was our discussion with Marnia Lazarek, who is the author of Foucault's Orient, The Conundrum, Cultural Difference from Tunisia to Japan. Thank you so much, everyone. See you next time.